It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Hello, my name is Jonabee. Working on distilling some of my religious beliefs into a short segment to share with a large group of people has been interesting, emotional, challenging, and a little intimidating. Oddly, the end product of having a several-minute written description makes it sound rather more tidy than it feels in real life. That said, I'd like to share with you what I consider to be the central parts of my religious belief. My religion helps me to interact with others, with myself, and with the divine. The first component, the one that's about my interaction with others, is based on my more expansive version of the Golden Rule. It's more than just treating people well. It's the idea that other things in this world and I are similar in some way, and that I should treat all parts of nature respectfully. I might not be exactly like my cats, but I recognize that they and I share something, what some might call a soul, what I usually term the breath of life. But regardless, something that deserves my respect. A mountain and I are even more different, but there's still something there that should be respected. The second component, the one about my interaction with myself, is how I gain perspective on life. In particular, I celebrate cycles in my life and in nature. Spring turns to summer, to fall, and to winter, repeating in sequence year after year. Children are born, grow up, and have children of their own. I recognize my place in these universal patterns. I'm also reminded that my life has cycles, including a physical process that repeats each month, and an emotional range from high to low, and back again in a more irregular pattern. My current condition is impermanent, and I am prepared for changes. The third component, the one about my interaction with the divine, is about the honoring of my gods. I take a polytheistic view that there are many gods that watch over different spheres of life. Gods aren't all-seeing or all-powerful, but rather act within their limited spheres of influence. Interacting with one is akin to what happens when I call up my mother-in-law to ask her for advice about cooking a meal. She can give me encouragement and suggestions, since she's an excellent cook, but in the end, it's up to me to cook the dish. Who I call up on a particular day depends on what I'm doing and who's good at it. For example, my main passion is writing. I'm a technical writer by trade and write a fair amount of nonfiction on the side. Because of that, and because of religious experiences I had while exploring my faith, the main part of my worship is devoted to Brigid, a Celtic goddess whose spheres of influence are, loosely, writing, healing, and crafting. Historical writings about Brigid talk about the fire in the head that she can bring to people, the inspiration or creative spark that strikes while trying to write or speak. Honoring that creative spark is important to me. In turn, there are times that I felt blessed by her fire of inspiration. I do hang a lot of concepts on the word God. It is a complex word that simultaneously means different things to me. I consider myself a theist and do believe that my gods exist in some manner, but I also view them as archetypes and ideals to aspire to, somewhat like heroes. I honor them by striving towards excellence at the activities that are within their spheres of influence. For example, when I trained for and ran in a race for the first time, I considered that to be an act of devotion to Lu, a storm god with strong sport associations. The preparation on the morning of my race included a short devotion to him. By choosing which gods to honor at a particular time, I can concentrate my focus on different areas of my life. I've tried to talk about my beliefs in a way that you can connect with and understand, but when I step down and return to my life, where my beliefs are alive and real, I express these statements in the shorthand of a creed that I wrote for myself. My creed has these three statements. First, that I should recognize and honor the breath of life within all things. Second, that just as cycles repeat in nature, they also repeat in my life. As such, I celebrate the changing of the seasons and the cultural holidays as my holy days. And finally, that it is important to honor my gods. My gods are mentors to learn from, archetypal ideals to strive towards, and symbols of the great unknown. Regardless of whether you view gods as real or archetypes, or both, I hope you'll consider the value of occasionally viewing the world through a polytheistic framework.
our service and the center of our lives, let us make time to honor the quieter moments of life. We may use these first few minutes to light candles of memory and hope, or just sit quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Let us attend to our sacred connections. We live suspended in a web of connections that bind us to all the people, relationships, and beliefs that can give and sustain life, and we must attend to those connections. Who are the people who cherish us, who see what is sacred in us and affirm it? They are some of the angels of our better nature. Let us attend to our connections with them. Who are the people who empower us, who urge us to sing our special songs and offer our unique gifts? They help attach us to our task in life. Let us attend to our connections with them. Where are those rare and sacred places in our life where we find power, purpose, and a mission capable of granting us both honor and a task? Let us accept them both the honor and the task, because there are so many others who also need to attend to their connections, and sometimes we are the only help they have at hand. And so let us attend to our connections, both those coming to us and those going from us. Let us attend to our sacred connections. Amen. When I was 21 and trying to sort things out, I went to see my minister. I told him that I was seeing a psychologist, but wanted to talk to him too. He wanted me to know the difference between what he did and what my psychologist was trying to do. That was new information for me, so I asked him what exactly it was that he did. "All I can do," he said, "is try to help you understand the gods you are serving and whether they're worth serving." All these years later, I still think that's about as well as it can be put. It's what we're about here. Years later, though, when I was in divinity school, I learned how hollow the traditional God language of Western religions has become, even among people who know it well, and how incapable it often is of really binding together our whole complex pluralistic world. The students who clung most tightly to the old ways of talking couldn't explain to themselves or anyone else exactly what they thought any of those powerful words meant. They were saying what they'd been taught to say, going through the motions as though it were still perhaps the 18th century. But when they got more clear about what they actually... excuse me. That was the act of a trickster god. It's how they show up. You never know. When they got more clear about what they actually believed, it was never traditional, it was seldom systematic and neat, and almost never very cosmic. A few stories here and there that they had used to get them through, some from the Bible, sometimes some from fairy tales. They planned to take the old stories to their parishioners in the faith that somehow the stories might work better for their parishioners than they actually worked for them. That's not a bad faith. Stories do have that power, and sometimes they work in spite of the fact that the storytellers are no longer captivated by them. But mostly, I think we have no really deep or nuanced knowledge of even our own Western religious stories, let alone others. Mostly today, we've lost the names of our gods and their stories. We aren't sure what to call the forces of life which still move us, disturb us, and empower us as they always have. Jonaby spoke of the inspiration that she sometimes feels, which she associates with the stories of the Celtic goddess Bridget, because she knows those stories and has found connections in them with her own life. But most people don't know of Bridget or the Celtic pantheon. Most don't even know much about the Greek gods or those of Egypt or the Norse group. And we're more aware in our critical and often cynical age that both gifts and powerful words can come kind of willy-nilly, but not on command. And we know that not all gifts are useful, and not all powerful words are wise. I think of just some of the famous people who have great gifts and great demons, or even minor demons, and can't seem to sort them out. You think of the rock singer Kurt Cobain a few years ago, who heard the sounds of great music and the sounds of madness, and finally listened most to the madness that drove him to suicide. Winona Ryder, with great gifts and a weird little demon. She certainly has the gifts of the muses for acting, and she can't seem to stop shoplifting. It's a different voice with immense power over her. Robert Downey Jr. is another very gifted actor who cannot seem to resist the siren songs of a cocaine addiction that has put him in prison and may put him there again. That's this generation's crop. There are always some. A generation ago, it was Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. Before that, Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker, geniuses with gifts from the gods and addictions from demons where the demons won. I like Jonaby's way of thinking of her writing as a gift from a goddess. It has always seemed to me that that way of thinking about it is not only most humble, but most honest. The first time I really understood what gifts meant was years ago when I began doing photography. I'd never done it. I didn't know anything about it. But I was in Vietnam, and I interviewed to be a combat photographer and press officer in the Vietnam War because I wanted that experience. And then I discovered, quite by happy accident, thank goodness, that I had a natural gift for photography. It was very surprising. I'd never owned a camera or cared about it. I never understood it. I never felt like it was part of me. It always felt like some sort of a pure, if strange, gift that somehow came through me, but didn't have much of anything to do with me. And I never felt ownership of the photographs. I even opened a photography studio after the war in Ann Arbor and did some expensive and even some award-winning portraiture and wedding photography for several years. I didn't like contests, but the one I entered, I won first place over 900 other professional portraits entered. And I was so removed from the gift of photography, and it felt so little like it had anything to do with me, that I remember walking through the gallery in Cobo Hall in Detroit and looking at all those pictures and thinking, yeah, I would have voted for me too. They're just better pictures. And I didn't feel like I deserved any credit for this if I had known of some sort of a God that I could have given credit for that, that's where the credit would have gone. What was odd for me about that gift was that I never liked it. I never liked photography. It was a gift that gave nothing to me. And a gift that doesn't give anything to you, if you haven't learned this on your own, is not a gift. It's a trap. And there are a lot of us with gifts that give things to others, but nothing to us, who are still in the process of learning that they're traps. I sold the studio, I sold all the equipment, I took no pictures for 25 years, and I never missed it. I didn't think of it at the time as any kind of a gift from a God, just a talent life had dealt me that life would have been smarter giving to somebody else. My minister's words from 40 years ago still ring true about searching for the gods that we're serving and whether they're worth serving. There's so many examples of people serving gods, living out gifts that either aren't useful to them or aren't worthy of God. When I was a boy, one of my friend's fathers was some kind of an accountant, and apparently he was very good at it. They had a very nice house. They had two cars before the time when everyone had two cars. They belonged to classy clubs, and his kids had better toys than I did. He, too, had some gifts that most accountants didn't get. And I remember asking him once why he did that work. I couldn't imagine anyone wanting to work with numbers all day. And he said he didn't know, that it had just seemed so easy and natural that he didn't feel that he had a choice in the matter. At the time, I registered it as a strange comment, but years later, when I sold a photography studio, I remembered that story and the rest of his story, and my heart went out to him. Because the year that I had that discussion with this accountant about why he did what he did, and he said he didn't know, he just felt that he had no choice, was a terribly traumatic year for my friend, his son, and all of his sons, because that was the year that he was arrested in a city park, where he used to go at night and expose himself to strangers. His gifts gave him a good living, but not a good life. And he said later that he felt so invisible that he resorted to what looked like sad and furtive activities in dark parks just so he could feel that somehow, somewhere, someone actually saw him. I imagine there are accounting gods. I don't think I want to know what they are, because they would put me in accounting hell because I can't balance my checkbook. Actually, I've never tried. I think in our daily lives, though, few of us associate things like this, even powerful stories like that, with gods. We don't talk that way anymore. We don't know the stories. We don't know the words. And so they've lost a lot of power for us. And so today I'm not sure if it's gods that we need to get in touch with as much as we need to get in touch with the creative powers in ourselves and in life and in the universe, of which gods are creative constellations. Because those powers and their connections into sacred and powerful potential, those proto-gods, are being formed in our lives today as they've always been. So today I brought you two stories about how gods are created and what they're made of. There's a different way through this forest. The first came from a novel that I finished a few weeks ago, one of the strangest novels I've ever read. How many here have read the book Life of Pi? Not many. It's a wonderful book. It's all of you who've read it would agree. It's certainly one of the strangest novels you've ever read, with an immensely surprising ending. I've never even read an ending that was surprising in that way. You come to the ending and suddenly realize the book wasn't about what you thought it had been about. And that raises it up a couple levels. So I can't tell you the ending, but I can tell you something about this odd story. It's about a 16-year-old Indian boy whose father is a zookeeper. He knows tremendous things about animals. Just that makes reading the book fun. But the zoo didn't work financially, and so they had to sell it. And the whole family decided to move to Canada. And so his Indian family and him and many of the animals from the zoo, who he'd known fairly well, got aboard a very rickety old boat, which wasn't very nice, but it didn't cost very much either. And they left India, and then tragedy happened. He lost his whole family. And what the rest of the book seems to be about is this odd lifeboat on which he found himself. With, at first, though you can tell from this list, this whole crew isn't going to last the story. Himself, a zebra, a hyena, an orangutan, and a 450-pound Bengal tiger. Now you can tell from the start that some of these are lunchers and some of these are lunch. And after several meals and complicated stories, there were just the two of them left, the boy and the 450-pound Bengal tiger, whose name was Richard Parker. It was just a clerical error. Richard Parker had actually been the immensely brave hunter who'd captured the tiger live and brought it to the zoo, and somehow his name got put in where the tiger should have been. What happens at the end, after they've spent 227 days together on this lifeboat and finally came ashore, is that you learn when you get to this very unusual and creative ending that Richard Parker turns out to be, as well as a 450-pound Bengal tiger, a kind of a god, a manifestation of power, of survival, and of transformation that quite clearly let this boy live, and without whom the boy would quite clearly not have lived. Now that's a god, even if it's big and fuzzy and smells bad and dangerous. Second story is much more down to earth and absolutely true. Comes from a physician in California named Rachel Naomi Riemann, who I've talked about before. I've loved her books, and this is a woman in her 60s who just seems to be immensely gifted with wisdom and insight and creativity. And she has such gifts that many other physicians and even psychiatrists refer patients to her now. And so she deals with extreme cases. Most of her patients are people who are dying, who have AIDS, who have cancer, who are doing chemotherapy, radiation, who are really in very tough transitions and need someone like her to talk to. And Rachel tells a wonderful story about creating gods, though it's not quite the way she told it. For over 20 years, she says that she has offered a very simple but very powerful ritual to some of her patients before their radiation, chemotherapy, or surgery. She suggests that they meet together with some of their closest friends or family the day before their procedure. It's important that the group be made up of those who are connected to them through a bond of the heart. She suggests that the patient finds an ordinary stone, just a stone, big enough to fit in the palm of their hand, and bring it to the meeting with them. The ritual begins by having everyone sit in a circle. In any order they wish to speak, each person tells a story about a time when they too faced a crisis. People may talk about the death of important persons in their lives, the loss of jobs or relationships, or even about their own illnesses. The person who is speaking holds the stone that the patient has brought. When they finish telling their story of survival, they take a moment to reflect on what personal quality they feel helped them through that difficult time. People will say things like, "What brought me through was determination. What brought me through was faith. What brought me through was courage. What brought me through was humor." And when they've named the quality of their strength of survival, then they speak directly to the person preparing for the surgery or the treatment, and they say, "I put determination into this stone for you. I put faith or strength, humor, love into this stone for you." Often what people say is very surprising. Sometimes they tell of crises that occurred many years ago when they were young or in wartime that others, even their family members, had never heard before. Or they attribute their survival to qualities that are not ordinarily seen as strengths. It's usually a moving and intimate meeting. And often, all the people who participate say that they felt strengthened and transformed by it. After everyone has spoken, the stone is given back to the patient, who takes it with him to the hospital to keep nearby and hold in their hand, if they like, when things get hard. Dr. Riemann has had several patients go to their chemotherapy, their radiation, or even their surgery with those stones taped to their hand or to the soles of their feet. Over the years, this is how you can tell this is a story of how gods are born. Because of the power. Over the years, many of the oncologists and surgeons in our community have learned about these stones from their patients, and they are very careful about them. One surgeon even had his staff go through the hospital laundry in search of a stone that was accidentally thrown away with the sheets in the recovery room. Rachel asked him why he had done such a thing. And he laughed out loud and he said, "Listen, I've seen people do badly after surgery and even die when there was no reason for it other than the fact that they believed they weren't going to make it. I'm only a surgeon. I need all the help I can get." A wise surgeon, but also a surgeon who could feel the power of a god. It was a local deity, but it was a deity with the power of life and death. Neutral things, stones, get loaded with powerful stories and meanings and wishes, and they carry them. Those stones become invested with so much power, they literally have the power of life and death. That's phenomenal. That's how gods are created. Names and stories of gods get loaded with messages and power and hope, and they get passed on. The patient in the next bed wouldn't get a thing out of your stone. You could get courage from it, even life. Those stories are like portable altars. so people can carry the reminder that they were touched and blessed by life. I'm reminded of a passage in the Bible that says, build altars in the places where I have reminded you who I am, and I will come and bless you there. We need to mark the places where we felt power and connection. Religion is about reconnection. And it's like an ancient picture the Greeks made. Wonderful picture. It's a picture of our soul, or really a picture of the human condition. And they pictured Psyche, the soul, as a spider sitting in the middle of her web. And from the center of the web are radii going out, connecting her world to the bigger world around it. And she sits in the center of the web, feeling those connections and attending to them and mending them. It's our job, attending to those connections that hold us up. It's a way of setting up altars where we've been touched by life. This window of votive candles is such a connection. It's amazing. It's been up less than 3 years. The first week it was up, I counted to see if it was going to be received well, and 72 people lit candles that first Sunday. A year ago, when we bought new candles, we realized that we had gone through in the previous year 2,500 candles. This year it looks like it's going to be more like 3,000 candles in a year. That's 12,000 hours of candles that have important, probably even sacred meanings to hundreds and hundreds of people who've gotten up and lit them. No one knows what those candles mean except the people who lit them. That's an altar. It's an altar marking a place where people feel power and connection. That's good stuff. Think of the other times and places in your life when you felt that power, when you felt called out or cherished or empowered, connected. Doesn't have to have happened a lot of times, and it probably hasn't. Though we need to be able to call those times forth when it happened and to reconnect with their power. One reason we have so much freedom of belief in liberal religion is precisely because the job's so hard. Because we each need a different combination of gods and voices and gifts who are for us worth serving, who give us life. Stories, stones, candles are like little seeds of meaning and empowerment, little god seeds that might, with our care and attention, blossom into centers capable of reconnecting us with ourselves and the best parts of our world. We're all in the center of that web, that Greek picture of the soul as a spider. We're all in the center of that web, attending to our connections. Those are the ties that bind us to one another, to ourselves, and to the amazing, miraculous powers of life and hope and possibility. Let us attend to our connections.